This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The pursuit of individual liberty and the desire for a common good are older than the founding documents of our country. The two governing philosophies have often come into conflict with each other throughout our shared history, from the American Revolution and Civil War to the New Deal era and the Tea Party Rebellion. In his new book, American Character, Colin Woodard traces the origins of this conflict to our country's distinct regional cultures and ideas about the purpose of government. He defines a quest for what he calls the ideological sweet spot in the balance between liberty and the common good. Woodard's search for fairness and equality of opportunity is no small task in our current polarized political environment. But the author sees the challenge as essential to the future of our civic discourse about how we govern ourselves as a nation. Today on The Exchange, we're discussing individual liberty and the common good with journalist and American Character author Colin Woodard. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And joining me from Portland, Maine this morning is Colin Woodard. He is the state and national affairs writer for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram, and he's author of the new book American Character, A History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good. And Colin, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's begin by talking a little bit about your experience as a journalist. And I'm particularly interested to hear about how you came up with the topic of this book.
Indeed. Well, this book builds off my previous book, American Nations, which is a book about American regionalism, what the real regional cultures are in the country and why. And the essential argument, which we can get into later, is that the regional cultures don't follow state lines, and each of them ties back to differences between the original clusters of European colonies on the eastern and southern rims of the country. And the reason that I got involved in that is because I was a Eastern Europe and Balkan history major in university, and I'm of the vintage where my junior year abroad happened to be in Eastern Europe. In 1989, I arrived for an exchange program in Budapest at the Karl Marx University of Economics, and when I left a few months later, communism was over. So it was being there during the collapse, and I went and spent the whole beginning of my journalism career as a foreign correspondent in Eastern Europe and the Balkans through most of the 1990s. I knew the history in the background, and it turned out that most people in Eastern Europe and the Balkans, for better or worse, do as well. And there is a region where, among other things, the strong and valiant cultural fissures and historical fissures between people don't always necessarily match the lines on the map. And this led to all kinds of potential conflicts and, of course, the wars in Yugoslavia that I ended up covering the aftermath of as well. So that immersion in the power of deep history to affect current events in all sorts of ways. I mean, you could be traveling, say, across Romania or across Poland, and you could almost see on the train the moment when you'd cross the boundaries of what had been the Austrian Habsburg Empire and when you entered something else. You know, Prussia in the case of moving north in Poland, or in Romania, you're crossing over the Carpathians into what had been the Ottoman Empire. And you could see it in the architecture and indeed in the street grids and the attitudes of the people you started encountering. So it's a very strong and marked cultural differences. I came back to the States and I started seeing them in North America as I traveled and was living in different parts of this continent.
Yeah, you talk in the book about your experience, I think, as a student in Romania at the end of the Ceausescu regime, and you talk about when the country decided to export everything. Say a little bit about that experience. I found it really interesting in the book.
Yeah, of all the places that I traveled then and during the 1990s, that was the most sort of horrifying and Orwellian and tyrannical. This was in a couple months before Nicolae Ceaușescu, the mad dictator of Romania, was overthrown. And it was a time when he wasn't giving visas, but we had kind of a connection at our university and somebody knew somebody in the embassy. So myself and two other students were able to visit at a time when nobody else was being let in. And Ceaușescu had decided all of a sudden to pay off the massive foreign debt he'd accumulated to build himself a palace, which is one of the largest buildings on the planet, and a bunch of other sort of white elephant projects. He decided to pay off that debt. He was going to do it all of a sudden and immediately by essentially exporting everything, even the things that the country needed, like most of the food and electricity and the like, to the point where when we were visiting there was only power for a few hours a day because all the electricity was being, you know, cut off in order to save energy to export it for hard currency to pay off the debt. So we were in these cities that were completely blacked out at night. There was no heat in the hotels for hours and hours, even though we were up in the mountains and it was late October. And the shops and stores were lit with only a 25-watt bulb when there was electricity. There was sort of a ban on how many light bulbs you could have, and it didn't matter much because the stores, like the butcher shops, contained long lines of people queuing up among empty glass butcher displays to buy fish heads and pig's feet because all the intervening parts of the animals had also been sent away for export. I mean, essentially everything in the – it was a secret police following us around and everybody else everywhere they went, and a said to be some incredible proportion of the population were informants for the Securitate. It was very much like George Orwell, his writing come to life right in front of you and, you know, genuinely pretty horrifying. Everything being run down, you know, even the currency, the money were these falling apart rags because they hadn't reprinted money since the 1960s. You'd have to fold it out just to this sort of greasy paper just to try to see what denomination you were holding. The streetcars were often limping along, you know, like those, you know, those buses that use a streetcar line. It's right. A bus that connects right. Up to an electrical grid. Some of them would be dragging themselves along with two or three flat tires.
That's and
would
just remarkable.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was a place that was being entirely run into the ground just to meet the foreign currency obligations of this one dictator. And nobody had the right to, you know, speak or do anything. People would be afraid to be seen next to us. You'd be standing at a bus stop and suddenly the surrounding passengers waiting to get on the bus would realize there was a foreigner there. And you'd look up and they'd all be – the circle had formed around you, you know, at about 10 feet diameter where everyone was just standing there silently looking at you. You know, it was a very, very disturbing place and an illustration of how bad things can get on one end of the spectrum with state power being entirely unchecked in the hands of somebody who's not a rational actor and doesn't have the public interest particularly in mind.
And as we know, both he and his wife were pretty quickly executed after the end of his regime. I encourage our listeners to go on Google and look up that palace. It's a pretty remarkable piece of state-driven architecture. So you describe a situation in which your experiences informed your thinking about the United States. So let's shift a little bit now and start to talk about the U.S. context. But first, I want to ask you to define a couple of terms. Liberty and the common good are kind of the two big themes in the book. For me, they always have a kind of I'll know it when I see it quality. I sort of know what liberty is and I know what the common good is, but it may differ for other people. So how do you envision these two ideas conceptually?
Yeah, the sort of dialogue in our country, the political conversation in the end is all about freedom and how do you theoretically maximize it and what's the best approach. And you have two essential camps or arguments that have, you know, everyone from moderates to radicals on both ends, and they orient around those two concepts, individual liberty being the most important thing or the common good or, as I like to unpack it, the perpetuation of a free community. And the emphasis, if you emphasize continuing a free community, that often means putting some restrictions on individual freedom in order to accomplish that. If you believe to err on the side of maximizing individual liberty, individual freedom, then you don't want to have those same constraints because the point is to have the individual have as few encumbrances as you can. So you end up with two different concepts about how best to maximize freedom across a society. And this is all presumably in the pursuit of liberal liberal democracy, which is defined in my terms as you're trying to create a society where ideally there's universal individual freedom. But the question is, how do you best go about that?
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Colin Woodard today. He's author of American Character, a new book about liberty and the common good. He's a reporter for the Portland Press Herald, contributing editor at Politico. He also writes for the Washington Monthly. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email at exchange@nhpr.org. And so we have a sense now what you mean by liberty and the common good. And for you, it sounds like the reason why these two are constantly in conflict in our country is because of this idea you mentioned of regional cultures that don't neatly correspond to our state boundaries. And maybe you could explain this concept. I think you say there are 11 regional cultures in our country, and maybe use the New England version, which I think you call Yankeedom, as an example of what you mean.
Correct. I mean, this is all important because you need to find a balance between individual liberty and the common good in order to move forward. But the argument is about where the balance point should lie. How do you balance those two aspects of freedom? And the problem we have, unlike most of our peer liberal democracies in Western Europe or in Japan, is that we do not have a broad consensus agreement on that answer, whereas most countries do. And the reason for that is because we're not a unitary nation state or even one with two broad cultures. We are a really complicated federation of 11 regional cultures today that you've described and I've identified. And each one ties back, or most of them tie back, to the differences between the colonial clusters of colonies that formed on the eastern and southern rims of the country. And the characteristics of those separate cultures are with us today, which is the remarkable thing. Each of those, the New England colonies set up originally around Massachusetts Bay and extending New England and largely influenced by the Puritan migration, had a very different idea of the kind of society they were setting up than, say, the Chesapeake area sort of tidewater cultures. Just to use those as two examples.
They seem to be two of the ones that are constantly in conflict.
Yeah, they're today the Tidewater one's becoming less important, but those were the two big, chunky, important ones throughout the colonial period and the early republic during the discussions of our Constitution and stuff, which one of the reasons that makes them interesting. But they're interesting also because you had a Dutch experiment around New York City. You had Scots-Irish pouring into the uplands of not only the South but the Ohio Valley. The northernmost extensions of New Spain, of the Spanish Empire in the Americas, coming up into the Southwest. But what makes sort of Yankeedom, the sort of New England colonies and the Chesapeake ones interesting, is they were founded roughly the same time and all by English people, and yet they were totally different because these sets of English people coming were entirely different. In New England, it was an experiment by a group of people to try to create a applied, Calvinist utopia in the New England wilderness, right? It's going to be a light on the hill for other people to see and a utopian experiment to try to make in what they thought was be a more perfect world, and that God wanted them to do it. And they were in an Old Testament-like covenant to do so and were chosen people. And the emphasis was on building this more perfect community, and it was going to be done through shared public institutions. So you had the meeting house and the taxpayer-financed public school immediately built in their frontier towns. And the emphasis was on the good and success of the community as a whole. And if the fear was that the great danger to freedom in the New England mind would be that a member of the community would end up rising up and becoming an aristocrat or a tyrant over the community, the way it happened back in England, because the Calvinists essentially saw humans as corrupted, and that you needed to keep an eye on one another, and that the natural default move of a human would be to go into the bad side unless you keep everyone on the good path. Mm-hmm. So there was that skepticism and pessimism about human nature, and that led to wanting to build constraints on the individual being able to rise up and become a tyrant over people. You go down to the Tidewater and to the Chesapeake area, and it was also founded by English people and also in the early 17th century, but not by Calvinists. It was founded by people who were largely the younger sons of English country gentry. They were the sons who weren't going to inherit the manor house, and they were coming to Virginia and to Maryland and to southern parts of Delaware in order to try to recreate the manorial system of the English countryside that they'd grown up in so that they could actually build estates. It was a fundamentally conservative idea because they were trying to rebuild exactly what had been back in England. And it was kind of like trying to create a 17th century version of Downton Abbey, right? You'd have a group of enlightened gentlemen who had responsibilities to those below them but were considered to be the natural and rightful and most capable people to lead society. And so that was the original model they were working with. And, you know, on one side you have people who are fearing the creation of an aristocracy. On the other side you have people who are the aristocracy who are ruling. And then
I'm sorry, go ahead. So basically you have these kind of enduring conflicts between these different regional cultures that are then manifest in kind of whatever the political debates of the day are.
Precisely. And they colonize separate stretches of the middle western part of the country and the northeast. They tended to avoid one another. So each had an almost mutually exclusive settlement band out until the 1830s and 1840s, which is the time when you first started to have large-scale immigration from not from these regional cultures and their origin points. Yeah. And because of that, if you extend out, most of the continent was settled by one or another of these sort of fronts, these settlement drives across the country. In the case of the New England, what I call the Yankeedom path, they ended up after the Dutch were defeated in New York City towards the end of the 17th century. They streamed over and colonized much of upstate New York. In fact, Massachusetts had claimed a huge strip of upstate New York as part of its claim to the Pacific. And by way of compensation, although they didn't get sovereignty, they got the land title to all of that land. And Massachusetts-based land companies settled the land and colonized it. Ditto for the Western Reserve of Connecticut, the part of Connecticut that's up against Lake Erie. That was claimed by Connecticut and settled by Connecticut-based land companies with Connecticuters. And most of the upper Great Lakes states were settled by people from either the Western Reserve of Ohio, the Yankee upstate of New York, or New England itself. And they brought with them the sort of institutions and cultural assumptions and values. And, you know, town meetings and the emphasis that I described from the early Puritans was kind of part of the ethos of that part of the country, but not at all the ethos of other parts of the country settled by people from other settlement streams who were bringing with them very different cultural and institutional assumptions.
And you have
that's the basic idea.
You have a nice there's a map in your book where you kind of sketch out the boundaries of these different cultures. You know, I found it very interesting to kind of see sort of where the demarcation lines were. We're gonna revisit some more of the early American history in a bit, but I want to talk a little bit about the current day, the current election, and ask you a little bit about this idea of finding a sweet spot. You talk about the challenge is finding that sweet spot between liberty and common good, and you've shown obviously that, you know, we go sort of too far in one direction, we get oligarchy. You go too far in the other direction, the common good, you get communism. But this idea of finding a sweet spot, I mean, that sounds to me like that's a very difficult challenge, given how polarized the country is today. We have a break coming up shortly, but let's start talking about this.
Yeah, well, it's a difficult challenge for humans in general because, remember, this liberal democracy thing, this idea that you would even think of, better yet, try to build a society where ideally everyone has individual freedom to the most extent possible, that is a very new concept. I mean, just the past 300 or 400 years have humans even been talking about it, and we've been experimenting with it for the past 250 or so with mixed results. It's very hard to do. Yeah, and for thousands and thousands of years, you know, the history of humankind has not been aspiring to do any of those things. It's been tyrannies of one form or another since the first, more sophisticated civilizations came into existence. So yes, finding the balance point is incredibly difficult. And as circumstances change, you're constantly having to shift around in the new circumstances. And if you have multiple regional cultures within your country that strongly disagree on where the balance point should lie, some of them very libertarian, some of them much more in the sort of communitarian ethos, then that's a recipe for having periods of deadlock, particularly at times when the dominant political formations in the country neither of them seem to have a platform that wins everyone over.
We got to take a quick break. We'll continue in a moment. Stay with us. It's The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, American Character, the struggle between individual liberty and the common good. We want you to call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. My guest today is Colin Woodard. He is author of the book American Character. He's a state and national affairs writer for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram, also a contributing editor at Politico, and he writes for the Washington Monthly. And again, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. exchange@nhpr.org is the email address. And Colin, before the break, we were talking a little bit about this concept of finding the sweet spot between liberty and the common good. And I was suggesting that in the current political environment, given how polarized we are, just how difficult a task that seems to be. And I guess my initial question to you is, do you think that this can be accomplished within the current two-party system, or do we need some other party that is more centrist? There seems to be kind of a sort of an implicit centrism here in the idea of balancing, and I'm wondering just how that fits into the current political environment.
Right. Well, it could be accomplished either way. I mean, we know that our constitutional system with a sort of winner take all electoral format means that ultimately the steady state is that you have two parties. You know, a third party, yes, can rise up, but if it's going to succeed, it needs to knock off one of the other parties. You know, the Federalists and the Whigs come and go, but ultimately the steady state is that you have two parties. So could it be that a third political entity comes to the fore and becomes dominant? Yes. Or could one of the parties shift its program and its ideals enough to capture this sort of latent supermajority? That could happen as well. So either in principle can happen. It's not going to happen, you know, this year or in the very, very short term. This is sort of a middle term process of, you know, several years or a decade that you would expect this kind of thing to happen. But what I'm trying to contribute is we're deadlocked. We're deadlocked because the Democratic and Republican parties, neither of them offers a program that wins over a majority of these regional cultures. And that's why we're in this highly polarized situation where neither grouping can control the levers of federal power in Washington. Now you need the White House, a filibuster-proof Senate majority, and a majority in the House. And neither grouping can reliably get that. We keep shifting back and forth in control, and it's leaving the federal government rather paralyzed, which is a difficult thing for the world to have the world's largest superpower unable to, say, reliably pass a budget or raise its own debt ceiling for the debts it's accumulated. It's a rather extreme situation in our history. So how would you do that? That was kind of the question I put forward. How would you, given the differences between the regional cultures, not what would I want, but what is the common ground, you know, common denominators from which you could build a supermajority where you'd have enough regional cultures together to reliably control the levers of federal power? Wouldn't all have to be one party either. And historically, these were trans-party coalitions that tended to be regional in nature. Today, the parties are sorted ideologically really for the first time in a century or more. But theoretically, how would you do it? What would that look like? So it was looking at our experience. The book takes you through our history, right, to try to identify how you would balance those things together. So yes, it can be done, and how it's done isn't really all that important. It's that people start focusing on what the ideals are that they could bring together that would actually give you a governing coalition so that the country could move forward. What's the sort of American consensus zone in the sort of middle 70% of the electorate, given our balkanized and fractured regional cultures? What would that look like?
So, Colin, let me ask you about a couple of the current candidates. Bernie Sanders, you mentioned somewhere, he's obviously did very well here, won the New Hampshire primary quite handily over Hillary Clinton. You mentioned in the book somewhere, I think towards the end, that Americans, and I'm paraphrasing here, don't really have a taste for social democracy. And I've heard Bernie Sanders many times cite Scandinavia as kind of a role model for the kind of government he envisions. He's quite straightforward about that. So I guess my question on him, and then I want to talk about Hillary Clinton, in sort of your conceptual framework, does that make him a self-limiting candidate if, in fact, Americans don't really have a taste for social democracy?
Yes. Americans at large, you know, in total, don't have a taste for social democracy. You can succeed in certain regions. And Yankeedom is one of the cores of his support. But in others that are strongly libertarian and emphasizing individual freedom as being the key to democracy, those have never been successful arguments. And indeed, any time that we've tried to move from the sort of New Deal-ish, what I call national liberalism space, move slightly more towards down the common good spectrum, towards collectivism, towards
right.
social democracy,
right.
It's been pushed back. I mean, social democracy, just to define it from socialism, social democracy is when you have a vigorous free market economy that is harnessed to have a strong social protections and social investments and possibly some planning in the economy. Socialism is when the state actually owns the means of production, and
right.
that's a whole other step.
Right.
But social democracies have been successful in many of our peer liberal democracies like Scandinavia because there's a consensus in those countries that that balance is fine and it's worked for them pretty well. But yes, the answer is that if you're trying to run on the national stage, not as a senator or a congressperson, you're going to encounter a firewall and a block when you're trying to move down social democracy, at least today. What I do find interesting about Sanders is a lot of his supporters are younger. And what intrigues me about that is that if indeed a lot of younger voters are more comfortable moving into that social democratic space than previous generations, that raises the possibility that there'll be a shift on that collectivism side where there was this sort of firewall against social democracy that FDR encountered when he tried to move forward with the National Recovery Administration during the Great Depression, or that LBJ ran into when he tried to push the Great Society into new realms of having the federal government try to solve problems, deploy and solve problems that it hadn't tried to solve before. If that wall may be moving as this generation gets older, which mm-hmm. will be really interesting to watch. But historically speaking, yes, there's a major structural and regional impediment to the social democratic platform on the national stage in total.
Let me ask you about the other side of the coin. Hillary Clinton has a relationship with Wall Street and her own significant wealth. Donald mm-hmm. Trump, obviously very wealthy. You mix in the Koch brothers as well. You mentioned the sort of genesis of their family fortune. Is this part of the oligarchy? I guess my question is, we seem to have kind of candidates sort of in the mix here that are kind of the sort of the direct opposite of what you're looking for in terms of striking a balance.
Well, if you step back and look at the full spectrum, it's interesting in a couple ways. If the spectrum you're looking at is individual freedom versus community freedom, extreme Ayn Randian libertarianism and collectivism are your far poles. Donald Trump, of all the Republican candidates, and there were 17 of them, he is the only one. He was off on the collectivist side. He was a collectivist outlier, so to speak, of all 17 of the candidates. That put him kind of in the middle. Remember, Trump had never been arguing that he's going to drown government in a bathtub, or indeed has not been arguing that he's going to cut any programs in particular. In fact, he's been promising to make America great again. He's going to reject trade agreements, which have been held up by the more pro-business Republicans for decades. He's going to reject immigration, which is also prized in the pro-business side of the community.
So you're saying he's wealthy, but he's not really talking.
Well,
like an
oligarchy. He personally is wealthy, and
he's
he is
not,
part of
he's
the
not really
1%.
Right?
But what I'm saying is the key to his success within the Republican electorate is that he ended up standing in more closer to the middle than the rest of the candidates, who were arguing that the other 16 candidates were saying in one form or another, if we were just to reduce the size of government and reduce taxes, then axiomatically that would mean more freedom, and that is the central argument: less taxes, less government, more freedom. Trump was the only candidate who didn't make that argument, and lo and behold, he vanquished all of the other candidates, including very well-financed ones from major dynasties. He's promising to represent the economic interests of a group of people who haven't been represented by either party for two generations, and it worked. Now, there's a dangerous side to Trump, which we can talk about, in that he's not playing by the liberal democratic playbook, but in terms of that axis, that's the interesting thing, is what he was advocating actually lies more in the middle of the spectrum between the individual freedom and the common good. Now, that can have a really bad side if your idea of the common good and the freedom of the community is very exclusive, where it doesn't extend to all citizens, and that you're not going to extend all of the liberal side of liberal democracy, the civil liberties to everybody, because that there are suspect people involved. But that's a whole nother can of worms.
I'm speaking with Colin Woodard today. He's author of American Character and the Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange at nhpr.org. And Colin, I have a couple emails that are going to take us back to the founding. But before we do that, I want to spend a few minutes talking about the 2010, the Tea Party Rebellion. And this is of great interest to me because there seems to be some real cross currents at work in that movement. And I'm interested to know if you think it's peaked. And let me tell you a little bit about an experience I had where I had a chance a few years ago to interview Ron Paul. And he was telling me how he had been initially kind of quite committed to the Tea Party movement. It was libertarian, small government, low taxes and spending, kind of cut across party lines. And then he told me it basically got hijacked by social and religious conservatives like Michelle Bachmann, Sarah Palin, Jim DeMint, kind of sort of key conservatives in the national movement. And then it just kind of became a rebranding of the social and religious wing of the GOP. So tell me a little bit about sort of how the Tea Party fits into these cross currents in your book.
Right. Well, the Tea Party emerged, remember, in the aftermath of the 2008 financial and economic collapse,
right,
and was fueled by enormous popular anger, particularly at the idea that some had been cheating and were getting away with it. In other words, that the people who had caused this crisis, especially the real explosion in the Tea Party movement, if you go back, you know, forensically and retrace the story, it goes back to when AIG, remember the big reinsurer, was going to be bailed out by the government to some incredible amount by the taxpayer. And it came out that the very people in the division in Connecticut who had brought down this reinsurer and almost, you know, push the dominoes over to bring down the world economy, we're all going to get huge bonuses, you know, millions of dollars for almost destroying the world economy, which in effect were being paid by the taxpayer. The white hot anger of that was just staggering at the time. And that's when the Tea Party movement and the Tea Party rallies really exploded. It was this anger at this, that the government was, you know, coddling the cheaters, and that there was, who had damaged it, and it was being done at the expense of sort of the middle class. There was that initial anger that really, really pushed things forward. And it's correct that, you know, what happened thereafter, that was a very much a grassroots movement that was happening, but the Jim DeMint and the Koch brothers and Freedom Works were working very hard to try to organize and harness some of that energy, and did succeed to a large degree in attaching it to a rather, you know, that libertarian individualist platform that Ron Paul was condoning. And that's what happened for a bit. But it was never quite that, because as people started, you know, really interviewing and academics started surveying and talking to Tea Party people and Tea Party leaders, it became fairly clear that actually a lot of the people who were supporting the Tea Party movement didn't want, you know, a lot of benefits that accrued to them to be taken away, especially Social Security and the home interest, the home mortgage interest deductions, and those sorts of things. It was, you know, that poster, government, get your hands off my Social Security, wasn't just a joke. It was this sense that the government was actually going to take away these entitlements and benefits that, you know, middle and upper middle class people had worked their lives for in order to, you know, either pay off the bankers or the unworthy poor was kind of the notion. So it was never quite a small government, strict individualism at work within the grassroots, although it did get captured and rolled up into that. It was a lot of, you know, justified upset and anger at that time period. And
yeah, I remember Ron, go ahead.
Yeah, and since I think devolved, like you said, has that peaked. Yeah, I think the Tea Party movement sort of became subsumed. A lot of social conservatives did take parts of it, which would upset a lot of the libertarian activists who'd become involved and disillusion them, and that caused cracks within the Tea Party. And I think that, you know, that as a single force, that's kind of that coalition has kind of come apart and flattened. And indeed, Trump is absolutely not a champion and an advocate for the, you know, the sort of Ayn Randian individualism that would have been advocated by, say, FreedomWorks.
Yeah, this interview the interview with Ron Paul, I think, was in 2012, and I just recall he was just kind of disappointed with how the whole thing had played out. Let's jump back to the time of Thomas Jefferson now. And again, for our listeners, this book, American Character, looks at liberty and the common good, really, from the colonial period up to the present. Our good friend Wayne emailed in and asked the following. Your guest made the point that regional conflicts have existed since the settling of the continent, and certainly since our founding. Jefferson argued for something called generational sovereignty. The idea was that each generation should have to ratify the Constitution for themselves, that it was unreasonable for a group of individuals to bind another group of people 100 years later to the reality of the former's time. And he's wondering what you think about that, Jefferson's idea. And I'll throw in there also, in the Federalist Papers, Madison talks a lot about the need to have a veneration for the Constitution and not be able to change it easily, and kind of pushing back against Jefferson there. So your take on Wayne's email.
Right. Well, it's somewhat of a separate issue. You know, when a set of people set up a constitutional order, how easy should it be to change it to meet new circumstances or changing thinking within the electorate? And while theoretically you might want to be able to have people every once in a while, you know, weigh in to make sure that the Constitution that governs their lives is meeting their views of things, I think as a practical matter, especially within the United States, that would be very difficult to accomplish given that what you must do in order to change the Constitution. So I think it's, as a practical matter, very difficult. And also you wouldn't want to do it too frequently because, the disruptive nature of that and the amount of time it takes to go about a constitutional project and to go through the public process and all that is a major consumption of civic concentration. So as a practical matter, I find it difficult to kind of envision how that would be done. How regularly would you want to do it?
Right.
To me, it leaves a lot of more question marks than anything else.
And we have a Facebook posting here about the Declaration of Independence, and the writer seems to be suggesting that that libertarians have interpreted the phrase about liberty in the Declaration of Independence in a way that bastardizes. This is the Facebook comment saying that libertarians have bastardized the meaning of the common good. So say a little bit about that, about how common good fits into that founding document.
Right. Well, the common good's mentioned in the preamble to the Constitution that's essentially the purpose of it. The common good carried out over generations is our task at hand and what we're trying to accomplish. But the argument is, what is the common good? What's the best way to accomplish that? How do you create this? What was 200 years ago, 250 years ago, a revolutionary society where you're going to try to have the people be sovereign and to try to maximize freedom? And we've changed we've increased and expanded the definition of who is a citizen and who's going to be able to practice freedom, and we've worked through a lot of challenges in a civil war. So it's a long and continuing project to do that. And our definitions of common good have shifted as time has gone on. So it's an essential conversation as to what the common good means. Perhaps the central conversation in our democracy. So. It's something that evolves, I would say.
We need to take one more short break, but there's lots more to talk about. We're going to talk a little bit about the 19th and 20th century, some big moments there between liberty and the common good. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today, we're talking about the book American Character with its author, Colin Woodard. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. As I mentioned, Colin is the author of American Character. He's also a journalist at the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. He writes for Politico and the Washington Monthly as well. And Colin, we've talked a bit about your book conceptually. We've talked about the kind of modern politics. We've talked a little bit about the founding. Let's jump into the 19th century. And every time I read books about the 19th century, it never ceases to amaze me the impact of the railroads on pretty much everything. And here you talk about kind of the railroads as sort of the prerequisite to the rise of the oligarchs and the Gilded Age. Just say a little bit about the impact of the railroad on liberty and the common good.
Yeah, it was a staggering effect because the railroads were a technology that suddenly shrunk, distance and time. Things that took days to get to suddenly took hours to get there. It was a way to move goods and people that almost nothing else could compete with. It required huge amounts of capital to build, especially when you started getting into long-distance railways covering vast and sparse areas. But once a railway was there, the only way to get things to market competitively was to use the railroad. And so the railroads had enormous powers over the markets and the they served and the companies they served. If farmers wanted to get something to a meat processing plant, they had to use the railways or else there was just no other way to do it. And the railroads at that time, as they were building and becoming these large and essential entities, the possibility for monopolistic control and behavior across sectors was very much there. And during the late 19th century, a time when there was a laissez-faire economic policy, they were able to do that to a great extent, forming these trusts where they would own the meatpacking plant at the other end, or have special agreements with them, and the involvement between these large cartels, each associated with a different railway, became something that very much shaped the economy and led towards that sort of Gilded Age extremes of having concerns about the concentration of wealth and also of economic power starting to destroy the possibility of having a free market at all. So the railroads were essential in all sorts of ways. They opened up the West. They knit the country together. They created a national economy instead of a set of tiny localized economies for the first time. But they also had unprecedented economic power and scale that was so large that it actually transformed people's ideas of what some of the threats to freedom might actually be and what government's role would have to be in checking and balancing those things.
And this ties into, you talk about industrialization and urbanization and labor laws and sort of just before the progressive era kicks in the early 20th century.
Right, triggering the progressive era in many to a great degree.
Right. Let's go to the phones. We have Dan calling in from Wolfboro. Dan, welcome to The Exchange. Dan, are you with us?
Hello.
Hi, go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Okay. Well, I appreciated your guest's comment about the Tea Party being generated by the outrage over the financial collapse occurring because of backroom deals that were essentially crooked. If not in the legal sense, certainly in the social sense. However, as time has gone on, both sides seem to, the right and the Republicans and the left and the outraged right on the Republicans and the outraged left on the Democrats see the government wanting because the culprits were never chastised or found guilty or paid any penalties.
Right.
And the reason that is important is that the government now has become the tar baby for left and right, and that's why there can't be a social compact. Nobody's going after the people who were out and out conning the system.
Yeah, Dan, thanks for that call. Let me jump in here and Colin, get your thoughts about Dan's suggestions about kind of the anger towards government.
Right. What Dan's sort of putting his finger on is that both, say, Bernie Sanders' movement and the Tea Party movement, both were angered that government, in their analysis, had been captured by special interests, that there was two sets of justice, and that the banking class in the 2008 situation was able to get away with things and not be held accountable for what they'd done, or indeed be rewarded for it. And there's been an outrage that's both a large spectrum of the American electorate, whether you're left or right or Sanders voter or Trump voter or in between. A lot of people have felt that sense, which is starting to get at some of the discussion that I have in the book about where the broad consensus is about the role of government and stuff in regards to preventing, making sure that our free society, we may have a free market but that it has to be played fairly. And so there's a great deal of anger out there across the spectrum with the fear and the notion that the system is, rigged in one way or another. And that's something that crosses a lot of lines.
So your idea of a doctrine of fairness sounds pretty well timed, given all the talk we hear on both sides about the election being rigged.
Correct. And I mean, because the book is looking I think the spectrum to understand American politics and the American conversation historically, that liberal and conservative aren't helpful and Republican and Democrat aren't, especially because those parties have essentially reversed their positions and constituencies over the past 75 years or so. But that if you look at it in the community freedom versus individual freedom argument, ultimately collectivist and libertarian, that spectrum allows you to really analyze and understand things more clearly. And that fairness argument in those terms, how do you balance those two forces, either of which left to run amok will lead to tyranny, but there's a sweet spot somewhere in the between where the two are in balance, where you can have maximized the potential for preferably universal human individual freedom. But neither one can run to the extreme. You have to balance the two. And the fairness doctrine, which we can kind of get into, is what I think the consensus in the United States across these regional cultures exists. And what the caller was talking about that shared outrage, points to that broad feeling of fairness in there.
Yeah, the one piece of the historical puzzle that we haven't really talked about yet is in the 20th century, and it's this kind of long block of time that you describe, really roughly from FDR's election in 1932 with the New Deal on up through Eisenhower and LBJ and the Great Society, really up until the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980. Can you talk a little bit about the significance of that block of time to our notions of the common good?
Right. This is sort of the greater New Deal order time space. I would say that the sort of New Deal consensus, as it were, that ultimately ended up being a bipartisan consensus, both parties supporting it. Eisenhower was supportive of it. That lasted from – it was founded in 1932, but after the war, there was a bipartisan consensus that ran up to about 1964. And then there's a period between 64 and 1980 when the New Deal order had kind of collapsed and right. Nobody was sure what was going to take its place until Reagan's election in 1980. But during that time period, say – especially from 1945 on through 1964, there was a broad shared idea that that it was the middle of the Cold War. There was a existential struggle in theory between atomic superpowers, and Eisenhower had come in, and a lot of people, Eisenhower being Republican, were hoping that Eisenhower was going to roll back the New Deal and return to the sort of laissez-faire, government is a night watchman only economy of the 1920s or maybe even the Gilded Age in the 1880s. And he didn't do that. He essentially stuck with the essential ideas of shared public investments made and often guided by the federal government in highways and building the interstate highway system, in basic science, in creating and funding land grant universities and sea grant universities, and investing in public infrastructure and stuff. And the reason he did that is because he felt that the common good, the survival of the country and possibly the world, required that the country be in the strongest and fittest shape possible to confront the Soviet Union and the menace that it posed. And in order to sort of make sure that his ship was in top shape, he knew that these investments were essential for the health and success of the republic. So he did it. And he was working with a generation who just fought World War II, where the economy was sort of collectivized in many ways, with the government, there was rationing, and the government and industry were working together to build a war munitions and warfighting machine that was able to win a two-front war in the Second World War. So there was this tradition, you know, and a lot of people had experienced this sort of shared national enterprise, and Eisenhower had capitalized on that.
Yeah,
so there was this idea, this sort of common good shared idea was much stronger in that period and had a broad consensus running up into 1964.
Yeah, it's interesting. A number of years ago, I did some research for a book on Eisenhower, and I spent a lot of time out at his archives in Kansas reading his daily diary, and he was very unhappy with conservatives in his own party and was sort of constantly at loggerheads with them. We have a Facebook comment here. The discussion on the Tea Party movement seems to be generating some interest. And this is Giovanni posted on Facebook and said, regarding the Tea Party movement, please comment on how it was actually engineered and financed by the Koch brothers and heavily pushed by Rupert Murdoch to torpedoing Obama's job instead of the true grassroots it was intended to be. So here's somebody who's suggesting that there really was an ulterior motive for the whole movement.
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the movement and the anger was real in grassroots at first, and that people were but once you have tons of individuals out there angry and wanting to do something, the next step is that somebody has to organize them as to what they're going to do, right? If it doesn't, then things don't tend to go very, very far because you don't have a sort of any organized, plan. And so, yes, we know that Freedom Works, which already existed, stepped in an enormous way, built websites, tried to train people how to do and start organizing, you know, here, come to our website to set up a Tea Party meetup. They would send people to act as trainers and were promoting a set of very libertarian individualist ideas to the Tea Party through their trainers and to the Tea Party movement. And that wasn't always successful. It wasn't as though everybody just lined up around them, but it was very well financed and did manage to become a major force in the struggle over what the Tea Party was to become. There were other people, you know, and entities trying to compete on that stage as well. But ultimately, you ended up in a situation where there ended up being a big conflict with libertarian-minded people who really felt that the solution was to reduce the size of government, that had intruded in our lives, that it had distorted the financial apparatus. Those people started finding themselves in open conflict with a more religious and social conservatives who weren't about individual liberty necessarily, who would put constraints on individual liberty around a collectivist or common good argument that, you know, they had about what the proper society should be. And those started becoming major rifts that that damaged the Tea Party movement to a great deal. So there was sort of a struggle and a civil war that emerged over what the Tea Party was really going to be about. And the Kochs were definitely, and Freedom Works were definitely strongly involved on one side of that battle. I wouldn't say that necessarily in the long term they won the war, but they were definitely a major force within the struggle for what the Tea Party movement should be.
So, Colin, we only have a couple minutes left. I'm interested to hear what's next for you. Are you going to – do you have any ideas about extending this project in new ways, or are you off to work on something a little bit different? Where do you first see yourself going with these these concepts in the future?
Yeah, well, one thing that I would like to be doing, the hardest part is getting the time to do it as I'm doing my different projects. But when you look at almost – any data set about the country, especially things where people try to look at things regionally. You know, normally regions are divided into, you know, the Northeast and the Southwest and the West and the South and the Midwest, all on state lines, and that completely obscures the actual regional cultures. If you start doing analysis from elections to, you know, consumer behavior to what magazines or cars people like to, sports teams to health indices, attitudes and social issues, all of those things have strong regional valences. And you can really understand what's going on much better if you do the analysis in that way. So I would love to, and I'm doing a little bit on an ad hoc basis with some researchers, to be doing this analysis sort of in a 538 way where you would provide real-time maps on a wide range of issues showing the regional cultural differences at different levels. And it would allow people to really understand much better what divides us and how in the real geography of the country in all sorts of ways, which I think would be constructive and illuminative for the national conversation.
So let me ask you real quickly, since we have about a minute left. Yesterday we did a show on congressional elections, and we talked a lot about the gun control votes in the U.S. Senate. It now sounds like your Senator Susan Collins is going to be right in the middle of this with some sort of a compromise. What are you hearing on that?
You've read as well. I haven't been reporting on that particular thing. But it doesn't shock me that on the Republican camp you would have Susan Collins. I understand that Senator Ayotte there in New Hampshire is also maybe a co-sponsor in that, if I understood correctly. It wouldn't totally shock me that you would have Yankee Republican senators leading the way from that side on an issue like this.
Real quick question. We're just about out of time. But in the response to your book, your reviews, et cetera, anything surprise you in sort of the reaction or feedback where you said, I didn't think about that or that's a good point?
Not particularly as of yet. I mean, some of the conversation is, whether those who haven't read and studied American Nations and are running into the regional paradigm for the first time, it takes them a little while to digest that and then take a step backwards. Those people who've already read American Nations and are familiar with that, I think, are already able to jump into the next conversation much easier. So I have to sort of create a synopsis of the regional cultures for people.
Sure.
The topic is very relevant to today's conversation.
Absolutely.
In all sorts of ways.
Absolutely. Well, we are out of time, and I enjoyed reading the book very much. I wish you luck with it, and thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
That's Colin Woodard. He's the state and national affairs writer for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. He's author of the new book, American Character, A History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good. And he joined us from Portland, Maine. And remember, the conversation always continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org.